Hello, folks. My name's Jimmy, and I'm an alcoholic. Hello, everybody. I'm grateful to be here and grateful to be sober. I love being sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Can everybody please take a seat so we can get started? Ask everyone for a moment of silence and gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 75 years. All right. One more time. My name is Jimmy and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Been kept sober since April 30th, 2001. My home group is the Three Legacies Group in New Orleans, Louisiana. We meet at 7 p.m. on Thursday night, so if you're ever in town, come see us, please. Who dat? And we have three great speakers with us today. We have Sharon, Jennifer, and Dave. But before we get to that, don't worry, I'm not going to be a fourth speaker. I've been in some meetings like that. There's a very special man that I met when I was about a month and a half sober, and I've been running with him ever since. And you know, he was the guy that let me know it was okay to be new. He taught me about prayer and a whole bunch of other things, and he just stuck his hand out and welcomed me and taught me how to help others. And he sobered up actually on the 3rd of July, 1974. So he's celebrating 36 years today, and I have a chip. Walter!
Thank y'all. My name is Walter Hall, and I am a grateful alcoholic. Only by the grace of a loving, forgiving God, I found the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. People like you in meetings like this, I hadn't had a drink since the 3rd of July, 1974. And it's an honor to be here at the International Convention again. What a deal, you know. This is, it reminds me of one of these old Baptist hymns. It says, what a fellowship, what a peacefulness, leaning on the everlasting arms. What a joy divine, what a peace is mine, leaning on the everlasting arms. This is a deal that you can't miss. And if you're on the edges of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you don't have a good sponsor, you're not into these steps, please do it. God has a life plan for you that you can't imagine. To watch young people like Jimmy come into this program and grab onto this thing with all the heartaches that he's experienced in the years that he's been here, this is what the fellowship is all about. It's about one alcoholic trying to help another alcoholic down the road of life. And I want to thank y'all, and I look forward to hearing the speakers. Thank you, and God bless you.
All right. Thank you, Walter. And now we're going to have our first speaker. We have Sharon from Marietta, Ohio.
Oh, my goodness. My name is Sharon, and I'm an alcoholic. And my home group is the Hand in Hand group that meets in Barlow, Ohio. Wow. There's probably a population of about 10 people there. Anyway, and I can tell you that on most Saturdays, there's 10 to 15 people there. So when I walked in this room, I about wanted to just die. Actually die. I sat back there for a while, and I got out the book, and I read the third step prayer. The first time I led, somebody told me, say that third step prayer and say that, relieve me of the bondage of self. And I've been doing that ever since. My sobriety date is November 17th, 1986. And for that, I'm extremely grateful. And with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous, a loving sponsor who has a sponsor, who has a sponsor, who has a sponsor, I haven't had to take a drink since that day, and I'm grateful. The topic is honesty, and when I called my sponsor, she said, just share your experience. And she said, you're pretty honest. And I thought, oh my God, I got to tell her something. But I didn't tell her that day. When I get home, I'm telling her. You know how we are. But my friend Jeff said, you're pretty honest. And I thought, well, yeah, sometimes not so tactfully honest. But I am grateful to be here today. And I'm grateful to be at this convention. Right before we came up here, I heard a speaker who had 60 years sobriety. Was that intimidating when I thought I had to come up here and speak? And he sang a song, and I will not do that. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my idea of honesty was, if I don't get caught, it doesn't count. That was my thought. And that's how I lived, not getting caught. And I thought I did a pretty good job of that. I didn't end up in jail, and I surrounded myself with people who drank more than I did, or people that would take care of me and make sure I got home okay and didn't get in too much trouble. But that didn't always work, but that was my plan. And I got here, and before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I grew up in an alcoholic home. And my father died at the age of 50 from cirrhosis of the liver. And I hated him. I hated him. And my first experience with Alcoholics Anonymous was men 12-stepping my father. And I remembered that when those men were in our lives were better. And but he could never get sober, and I hated that man. I hated him. And so we had a budding alcoholic and an alcoholic living in a home, and I always thought I was just a victim until I got here, you know, until I began to work the 12 steps, and I saw that I wasn't a victim, that I victimized people. Anyway, I grew up in this alcoholic home. I'm Irish. I'm Catholic. You know, my grandparents came from Ireland, and we lived near them and with them sometimes. And people drank. But I watched my dad dying from this disease, and I said, I'll never do that. I will never drink until I took that first drink. And then I knew it made everything go away. Everything was okay, you know. And but that, I still said that thing, I'll never be like him. I'll never drink like him. I gave up the I'll never drinking to I'll never drink like him. And I continued, you know, to spout that euphemism. My alcoholism and my drinking progressed. But I was blind to it, or I didn't want to see it. I knew what alcohol could do, and I just didn't want to look at it because I was having fun. And I continued to drink that way, and I grew up I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I grew up in this, like, I went to college and during the late 60s, early 70s, and I was a hippie, and I loved that. I loved living that way. I love that craziness. I love the alcohol and all the things that went with that. But I was going to change the world. I was that kind of person. Well, I'm going to change the world as I'm drinking myself to death. But I had fun. I had a great time. You know, and alcohol did for me what nothing else could do for me. And as my drinking progressed, I kept I never looked honestly at what I was doing with my life, because it looked, on the outside to people, it looked okay. But I had this rage. I was always angry, and I was always, but I was like two different people. And I never could make it be one person. You know, in the bar it was one thing, and in college I was another thing. And I continued this cycle. And like I said, I didn't get, people thought I was a nice girl, and I didn't let people see what I was really doing. Because I did all those things that we all do, you know. But I just, it was only in the bars that people saw me like that. I don't know if that's even true, but I thought it was. But I wreaked havoc on my family, and I thought they were treating me wrong. So all this illusions about who I was and what I was, was dishonesty. Alcohol quit working. And I moved out of, I was living in Marietta at the time. And my first husband was very ill at the time. And I got involved with this person who I thought was an Al-Anon. And I remember offering him a drink and him telling me he hadn't had a drink in 7 years. And I thought, I never met anybody that hadn't had a drink in 7 years. What the hell? Anyway, I'm just acting like this nice little Al-Anon person, and I'm drinking after the meetings and doing all this other stuff, but I didn't tell him that. And another lie. And what happened is, of course, we started to live together, of course. You know how that is. And I started to go into these rages, and I would do these things, and I tried to stop drinking, and I found that I couldn't not drink without, if I tried to not drink, I was crazy. I was absolutely crazy. I raged at him. And one night we had this huge argument, you know, he's leaving, I'm leaving, you know how that is. And he said to me, "Do you think you have a problem with alcohol?" And I said, "Maybe." And I said, "But I'm not talking to you about it." Is that an alcoholic woman, right? Anyway, he took me somewhere. I went and talked to a friend, a man I had met in an open AA meeting, who gave me those 20 questions. And I answered yes to those. When the moment I said maybe was probably the first honest comment I'd ever made about my drinking. And when I said that maybe, he took, you know, it was my moment of clarity. Because I knew my father had died of this disease, and I knew if I even ever admitted it, I was going to have to do something about it. And I thought, I went and took those questions. The man said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to AA." Because I knew that AA helped drunks. Now, I didn't know it was a spiritual program, and I didn't know anything about that. Those were my moments of clarity there, that God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Ended up in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Told him I was an alcoholic. Another moment of honesty. And I wasn't really sure I was an alcoholic, as I thought, I don't know what else to do. I'd spent years in counseling, and I had a whole library of self-help books, and none of them worked. You know, they didn't work. I couldn't fix myself. I needed that spiritual answer. And I ended up in these rooms, and I thought, they kept telling me, keep coming back. And I thought, I'll come back. I'll keep coming back. And I began to see, and I believe this is a spiritual thing, I got a sponsor, and I began to see the progression of my disease. And, you know, and somebody told me early on, in the fourth chapter, there's two questions. And when you honestly want to, honestly, find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. And it goes on to say, if that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. And I thought, well, that's me, because I was able to look at my drinking honestly and say, yes, I never could stop, and I never knew what the heck was going to happen when I started drinking. And through this program, I began to work the steps. And I began, and when I got to that fourth step, I thought, I'm not doing this. I'm not writing these things down. I don't want to put these things down on paper. Picked up that pencil and paper, and things that came out on that paper, I just couldn't believe they were there. You know, it was stuff that I would never admit to anyone. And they were there on that paper. And that resentment against my father went away because I was able to look at my part, which I think is such a big part of sobriety. For me, that was a big part of my honesty, looking at my part in that fourth step. And I thought, oh my gosh, I thought I was this wonderful person, you know, who just everybody in my family was afraid of. And I didn't even know that until I put it on paper. I didn't know that. Those things, that fourth step is so important. It was so important for me. And when I sponsor people, I just try to stress how important it is to be as honest as you can be. And it was just, that was a spiritual experience for me. The resentment went away, and I can't even conjure it up, that resentment against my father. It's gone. I lived 40 years with that resentment, and just that another moment of clarity, another honest attempt at honesty. and all it was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself again. And I've been in this program for a while, and I continue to try to be as honest as possible because my life has changed from being honest. From me being honest, I've learned to live a different way. I couldn't, you know, I don't care, you know, it's no longer, it doesn't count if I don't get caught. That doesn't work for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I have to be as brutally honest as I can be. And I, you know, I first came here and, you know, we read How It Works. I heard that the first time, and there's like three or four references to honesty in the first paragraph. And I thought I was cash register honest, you know, that honesty. I thought it was only about money or something like that, and it's so much more than that for me today. That's the way my life is today. I was thinking about, I was privileged to serve on the 57th General Service, at the 57th General Service Conference, and I was thinking about service and honesty. Nothing like a room full of delegates getting up and telling you what they think and how they're honest, the honesty there is there. And it's like, okay, I've had enough. But what a wonderful experience that was for me to watch those people, you know, fight for what they believed and argue for what they believe and still go, all for the betterment of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was a wonderful experience. I've seen that all the way from the General Service Office down to my home group. Everybody wants the best for Alcoholics Anonymous, and we are honest. I mean, we attempt to be as honest as possible. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love the fellowship. I love the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I never thought I could live this way. And it's just, I'm just amazed sometimes that I'm here. You know, I'm amazed that I don't live that crazy way I used to live, where people, when I got angry, people stepped away from me. And today that doesn't happen. And, you know, when I sponsor people today, I try to be as honest as I can with them. And God put this lady in my life in the last few weeks that is struggling. I mean, she's a battered woman, and she almost died. And I thought, you know, bringing her through these steps has been interesting. But I've learned here that if we don't do this, we don't stay sober. If we don't do this, and if we don't carry the message, I won't stay sober. And I've been told that from day one when they told me, they let me make the coffee, and I don't even drink coffee. But they told me, fill it to this line, and that's it. And I've learned, and they said, this is how you stay sober. You know, I have to have service in my life, because without that I don't. And I'm struggling very, very hard not to be a bleeding deacon, but it doesn't always come off very well. I like to argue with the other past delegates in our area. They usually win, but that doesn't mean I stop. I love the program, and I continue to do service in Alcoholics Anonymous because it keeps me sober, keeps me honest, and it just adds something to my sobriety. Glad to be here. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Sharon. Next, we have Jennifer from White Horse, Yukon, Canada.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jennifer, and I am an alcoholic. I'm from Area 79, District 52, Whitehorse, Yukon. If you're not sure where that is, our neighbors are Alaska. My home group is the No Puffin Big Book Study, and my sobriety date is November 14th, 1999. Wow, what a privilege to be asked to share. Thank you. As an elder statesman taught me, when I do some form of service, it keeps me in the solution. I don't know about you, but I can't think my way out of this disease of alcoholism. I have to act my way out. And through action, I am transported out of that lonely, angry, self-centered space and given the gift of recovery one day at a time. So again, thank you for my recovery. So, this topic on honesty and recovery for me is a process. When I came to these rooms, the only thing I thought I was being dishonest about was my drinking. Boy, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous sure showed me differently. And it is still growing deeper as I continue my journey in sobriety. I was introduced to alcohol at quite a young age during the holiday seasons. I was given a glass of wine during the meals. Right from the start, I loved that warm, free feeling it gave me. As I became older, I found myself sneaking my parents' booze and let my mom take the blame when my dad noticed the amount of liquor was depleting in the bottles. I found that alcohol gave me the courage when I was afraid, calmed me when I was anxious, relaxed me physically when I was tight and in knots. It became my solution for living because it made me feel that everything was rosy. It worked well for quite some time, but then took everything I cared about away. My health, my self-esteem, self-worth, which led to all my relations. 20 years ago, I entered the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not want to be there. I wasn't like you people, and all I was listening for were the differences instead of the similarities, so I could continue to justify my actions. I wasn't ready to look within myself because I was too busy pointing the finger at everyone else around me. I stayed dry for 6 years, doing it on my own. And at the end, I was miserable. Even though I was married, had a beautiful child, I just didn't want to go on. I didn't know how to live, but I was determined to do it on my own. The marriage came to an end, and that is when I chose to pick up the drink again. Find a new man to make a family and to move. I believed I could control the drink, but the seed was planted and I knew I was in trouble. Deep down, I was scared to stop drinking because I might seizure again. So I went to a doctor and he gave me some medication so I could come off safely. The new relationship, the new location didn't work. The pain of living was so great that I chose to pick up the drink again. I thought all of these situations drove me to drink. And when I tried to fix things and couldn't, my drinking went out of hand and I became alcoholic. It never occurred to me that I needed to change me to meet conditions. I have gone through 2 detoxes, 2 28-day programs, a day program, and had attempted the 12 steps twice and quit. I then went through the whole 12 steps. I thought I was being rigorously honest, but later when looking back, I was taking my partner's inventory instead of my own. I had to stop doing it my way. I can't do this on my own. I need help. I reached my bottom and was ready to do how it works. Honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. I started doing what you people suggested. Get and work with a sponsor. Go to meetings, read the literature, do the 12 steps. After attending many meetings, I was able to see broken people come to life. And this gave me hope, and I started to believe in the program. I was able to see step 1 in 2 parts. I had no problem admitting I was powerless over alcohol. I did have a problem that my life was unmanageable because I was only looking at the outside stuff, such as I had a job, a car, paying the bills, a roof over my head. You people gave me the strength and courage to look within and see the lonely, empty, dark state I was in. All I can say that until I truly looked at my part, there was no progression, self-development, or personal understanding. The Serenity Prayer, which, by the way, really saved my butt and still does, helps calm me, giving me strength to carry on and to stop me from fooling myself. You told me that this is an inside job, and working through the steps and living them would lead to the solution. That God's will for me is to stay sober so that I can keep trying to be the best person I can be. I would do activities with my friends in the program, and these friends showed me how to live sober and did call me on my stuff, allowing me to grow. My God works through people. You also said the program would teach me to be responsible for my thoughts and actions. The result? I started to feel comfortable in my own shoes, feeling pretty good about myself. An overwhelming feeling of I am not alone came over me. And I had some moments of calmness within, but of course wanted more of that feeling. I had put a couple of years in the program, helped out a bit before and after the meetings, setting up and cleaning up. I spoke with my sponsor, saying, I think I'm missing something. Right away, she said, it's time you get into service. Wow, this sure has been an experience of self-discovery. It has allowed me opportunities to learn, have a greater understanding, which has deepened my passion for Alcoholics Anonymous. The most rewarding part of my service journey is the opportunity to meet and make new friends in the fellowship that saved my life. It has given me insight to see myself in action, where sometimes I don't like what I see, and even when I don't see it, I feel it, and have the opportunity to change and grow. I need Alcoholics Anonymous, and in doing a little service keeps me sober. And as the late Bernard B. Smith wrote, the recovery of a child being born tonight, destined for alcoholism. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a life filled with God, a wonderful partner, family, and friends. My days are full, and I know whatever comes my way, I'll be okay. I want to thank you all for my recovery. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jennifer. That was great. Next, we have Dave from Phoenix, Arizona.
My name is Dave, and I am an alcoholic. I currently live in Arizona, Area 03. My home group is the Papago 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, and I currently serve as the alternate delegate to the area, and grateful to be of service. My sobriety date is April 19th, 1978. And if you know me or anything about me or how I grew up, that's a real miracle. I'm also, though, a native Texan. all right. I was born and raised in Houston, Texas. All right. And I sobered up just down the road in Austin, Texas. So, also, the last time that I was in San Antonio when I was drinking, I was celebrating my 21st birthday. I ended up that night in the New Braunfels County Jail, so. all right. Probably one of my cellmates. So it's really a great homecoming to come here to San Antonio to be, you know, and it's a great place to hold a convention, too, an AA convention. You know, I was realizing that just down the street about 180 years ago, they had this battle called the Battle of the Alamo, right? And there was a small band of Texans, you know, that held out against an army of 5,000 Mexicans. And they just wouldn't surrender. I mean, you know, who does that sound like? So. So, on this topic of honesty and recovery, I've got a few talking points. I mean, this is really, for me, it's such a deep subject because it hits so many different areas and so different many levels of my sobriety. And, you know, we in AA, we tell our stories of recovery by saying what it was like, telling what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And, you know, telling our stories is healing. It's not only healing to those that hear our stories, but it's healing for those that tell our stories, you know. And this has given me a real opportunity to kind of reflect on, you know, what honesty has really meant to my recovery. And so it's been a really good exercise for me. I really appreciate this. So I want to be able to tell you, you know, and what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now with respect, you know, to this topic of honesty. In Arizona, lots of times they'll start a topic by, you know, looking to a dictionary definition of some of the words, and that's not a bad thing for me. It kind of grounds me. I looked up what the dictionary definition of honesty was, and it says it's fairness and straightforwardness of conduct. Adherence to the facts implies a refusal to lie, steal, or deceive in any way. implies trustworthiness and incorruptibility. To a degree that one is incapable of being false to a trust, responsibility, or pledge. Oh, my God. And stating facts and views as one truly believes them, both to others and to oneself. So the way I summarize that is simply stated, honesty means to me expressing the truth and being able to remove the barriers that block the truth. And then I looked up the word recovery, and that was kind of surprising. It's, you know, it says that recovery is restoration from sickness, weakness, faintness, or the like. Restoration from a condition of misfortune. And then I like this one, the process of combating a disorder. And I like that word process. As alcoholism or a real or perceived problem, the act of regaining or saving something lost to restore. So this immediately, you know, reminded me that our second step speaks directly to restoration. It speaks to the restoration of sanity through a belief in a power greater than ourselves. So I think this, you know, putting these two together, it's very apropos, you know, that honesty and recovery for me, you know, honesty was a tool that helped me to recognize the illusions and false beliefs that I had in my life that helped me to perpetuate essentially a spiritual insanity that was going on. And then I went to our big book, you know, which I love. You know, the big book for me today, even after so many years, continues to reveal to me things about me that I need to pay attention to. And, you know, in Arizona a lot we read chapter 5 at the beginning of meetings. And there it says, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And it goes on to stress, it says about those of us who cannot recover, it says there are such unfortunates, they are not at fault, they seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. So, I mean, our big book just stresses over and over again how important this is to recovery. So, just a little bit about before I sobered up and, you know, kind of some of the beliefs I held. You know, it was all about me. That's the main thing I believe. My main concern was that I got what I wanted, and that I was happy and didn't have to experience any sadness or pain. I believed that I could, as the big book says, wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if I only managed well. And why not? Didn't I know best? and then that I could also do anything I wanted as long as I didn't get caught. I never looked really a lot at how my actions impacted and hurt others. If I did get caught, I could lie my way out of it, or I could blame others. I also learned to lie to myself and learned to avoid looking at the ugly truth about who I was. And what I have become to learn is that I really just lied to make things appear the way I wanted them to be and not the way they really were. And many times these lies weren't just real black and white. They were very subtle lies. Some of them I'm still dealing with today. Then when the lying stopped, the alcohol helped to really deaden the pain, and it helped fuel that delusion that life was either good or at least that I was right. So like I said, you know, these beliefs and others like them led to kind of a spiritual insanity that was my alcoholism. I lived in a self-centered illusion wrapped in fear that slowly cut myself off from God and others. So what happened? At 22 years of age, my alcoholism found me broke with a bankrupt business. I was in debt. I was living in a pay-by-the-week motel. I had no idea where I was headed in my life. My family, nor acquaintances, nor friends wanted me around. And yet I only had a vague notion that things weren't right. Through God's grace, I was taken to my first meeting. On my own, see, I wasn't able to see that I had a problem, that I was spiritually and physically bankrupt. And what happened at that first meeting was a really neat thing, because at that first meeting, I not only identified what my problem was, but I saw that there were others just like me that held a solution. So I had hope that was given to me. But what happened was, is I immediately set out to prove to you that I did what you had, but I immediately set out to prove to you that I was smart enough and worthy enough to get what you had. I had no clue what it really took to get this. But the hook had been set. You know, I knew there was a solution, and I knew my life wasn't working. After about 6 months, during which I stayed for a short time in a halfway house, and then I was kicked out, and then I stayed a little longer at a drunk farm outside of Austin, and then for an even a little longer stay at the state hospital. I got to the place where after about 6 months, I couldn't make this program work. I was kind of at that jumping off place that they talk about in the big book. I was unable to imagine life with alcohol or without it. For the first time, I conceded to my innermost self that I was truly powerless over alcohol and that there had better be a power greater than myself that could help me. Otherwise, I was doomed. Circumstances had made me willing. At that point, for the first time in my life, I really sensed that there was a power greater than myself that loved me and that could help me. And that was just a real wonderful moment for me in this program. And I think that's what started me, that's what turned this program for me into a spiritual journey. And it's all about what they call this gift of despair, you know, the first step. It's really a gift. For the first time in a long time, I had gotten honest with my core self. Through this gift of despair, I had become humble, and when there was nowhere else to go, I admitted the fact that I was truly alcoholic and powerless, and it was there that I found God's healing amidst the wreckage of my life. Later, what I came to understand was that God sees me truly for who I am, and if I can connect with the truth about who I am, God and I can kind of see eye to eye, maybe just briefly for a second. But if I hide from myself, I'm hiding from God as well. So that's not where it ends with this honesty business, right? We all know that. You know, we've had this little fourth and fifth step. And really what I learned about was through the fourth and fifth steps was to get down to the causes and conditions of my broken life. The moral inventory of the fourth step taught me to see how my actions and behaviors hurt others and isolated me. In step five, two things happened when I got honest with another person. First, the secret was out. By sharing my fourth step, I had to let go. And in that letting go, I no longer had control over who I wanted you to believe who I was. Second, with the aid of my sponsor, I was able to spiritually connect the dots and see how the hurtful behavior that were uncovered on the surface of my life through the fourth step really had underlying some exact natures. There were some core false beliefs about myself. And what these core false beliefs were they were the basis of the trouble that really centered into my mind, which is what the big book talks about, you know, where the problem is. So the first core belief that I held was, is that, again, it was all about me. You know, it was kind of like the central core belief that drove everything. And our big book says that, that selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problems. It goes on to say that driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of others and they retaliate. And then finally, it warns, above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of the selfishness. We must, or it kills us, and God makes that possible. So the delusion that the world revolved around me and that I could manipulate and manage it led, as the book says, to stepping on the toes of others. And when, not if, but when they retaliated, I reacted in fear and anger, which drove me into deeper isolation. And this isolation, it's a real characteristic of the disease of alcoholism, at least for me. And it's really fatal, because when I separate myself from God and others, or when I separate myself from others, I separate myself from God. And to separate myself from God is really dangerous, because that's the source of the strength that keeps me sober and keeps me alive. Just a few of the other false beliefs that I hold, okay? My way is the right way. Now, these are false beliefs, okay? I have this belief that I won't be taken care of, that it's all up to me. I have this belief that I don't need your help. I can do it on my own. I have a belief that I will lose what I have or I won't get what I want. That it's okay so long as I don't get caught. That I'm okay, you're not. Or you're okay and I'm not. And that you have to like me for me to be okay. That's another one of these core false beliefs that I have. But my all-time favorite is, it's your fault. So these are just a few, but there are many more. What these false beliefs are, it's like that in the spiritual, the appendix about the spiritual experience where they have that quote. And they, it says that what happened was is these false beliefs, they led me to contempt prior to investigation. They served as a bar against all information, as proof against all arguments, and acted to keep me in everlasting ignorance. So what happened was is that even though I, through this fourth and fifth step, I had digested a lot of the self-knowledge, I was really unable to bring about any relief as a result of it. In fact, the pain probably increased because I still held on to a lot of these deeply ingrained beliefs and suffered from them, but now I was painfully aware of the trouble they caused. And so I was kind of at another jumping off place in my program. And that's where the steps 6 and 7 showed up. And again, you know, it said that my difficulties, as our book says, centered in the mind. This is where the defective thinking based on misguided beliefs drove defective action. And this is real cause and effect stuff. It's real logical if you think about it. But as the book says, I could not wish these away any more than alcohol. How then was I to deal with my self-centered, egocentric thinking? This is where I looked to steps 6 and 7 with the guidance of my sponsor. And let me tell you that sponsors and people in the program, that's what keeps me going. I don't figure this stuff out on myself, on my own. I get led every step of the way. But what I learned about this sixth step was it was kind of like having a tooth go bad. The pain makes me willing to have it removed, okay? But it takes more than that, and that gave me the willingness. But it, in the case of a bad tooth, it takes more than just being willing for the pain to go away. You have to get to the dentist and get it removed. In step 7, I learned to abandon myself to God and His care unconditionally. This has turned out to be a lifetime process. This is not easy stuff. In the third step, I had made a decision to turn my will and life over to the care of God. In the seventh step, I had to actually start doing it. By abandoning myself to God's grace, I really did start to find real healing. All I can do really is just be willing. God has to do the rest. And that really, I now understand why there's so little said about the sixth and seventh step in the big book. Because it's all about God's grace, and that's mystical. And there's not a lot you can say about it. It's just, all I can say is it works. It really does, just like the book says. And then there's more honesty, right? We have our 10th step. You know, and this 10th step is a spiritual exercise I work daily with, right? I continue through this self-discipline of examination and self-disclosure to stay honest and humble about throughout my day. I look to see where I'm resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid. Or if I owe someone an apology, lots of times I still owe people apologies because I can be a real piece of work some days. Or if I kept something to myself which must be shared with someone at once. So, you know, again, keeping connected with you people, the people I sponsor and my sponsor, really important. I'm also warned in this step, you know, that I don't want to get into the morbid reflection and the deliberate manufacture of misery. And it's real easy for my mind to want to take me there. And then I just want to touch a little bit on the 11th step, because I've come to find out that this step is probably one of the most important tools for getting honest about the real spiritual reality within me. And I think this is really where the program is taking me. For many years, the meditation of step 11 was something I didn't practice. The truth was I didn't know how, and I simply wasn't ready. My head was mostly filled with this monkey chatter, this monkey brain. And what it was distractions, and they drowned out the deeper truth about who I was. And by engaging in this chatter, I burned up energy foolishly, as the big book says. And then what I found is today, through my meditation practice, where I've learned to simply get quiet for about 20 minutes twice a day and practice not latching on to my thoughts, but just allowing them to come and go. What's happened is that I've learned to open up some space between those thoughts. And that's where the real great reality kind of shines through, you know, and God's able to come in just a little bit, you know, and peek through the clouds, as it were, in my life. That's the great reality deep down within that the big book talks about. And it's a truth beyond words. It's a truth that's in God's first language of silence. And in the last analysis, just like the big book says, it's there that I find my higher power. And it's a very restful and restorative place. Again, all I can do is just show up and shut up, you know. Okay, I'll get finished here in just a sec. All right. So the big book says, you know, that we have come to believe we'd like to keep our heads in the clouds with him, but that we should keep our feet planted firmly on the earth. That is where our fellow travelers are, and that is where our work must be done. For me, keeping my feet firmly planted, the real reason that I have to stay connected, because that's a hard thing. Let me just talk to you a little bit about what's happened in the last 5 years to me. I've really experienced what the unmanageability that they talk about in the second half of that first step is about. You know, the first half of the first step got me to this program. I'm becoming to believe that the second half of the first step is what keeps me coming back. Some of the sorrows that I've experienced in the last 5 years. First of all, I lost my marriage of 25 years. And the thing about that is I didn't have a clue that my wife wanted a divorce until she told me. You know, I'm living in this illusion again, you know, that everything is great. And then I lost, my 25-year career. I was laid off. And again, I knew they were having these layoffs. And for the first time in my life, I felt like, well, I'm not going to get laid off. And boom, I got hit. You know, so again, I'm like living in this illusion. You know, I'm disconnected from reality. And then there's other losses which, you know, they don't really have anything to do with me, but they impact me deeply. A year ago, I lost my brother to cancer. I was very close to my brother. I lost another sister, my oldest sister, too, as a direct result of this disease many years ago when I was sober. I also lost my dad when I was 11. He was a chronic alcoholic. But probably the most difficult sadness that I've gone through and the hardest thing for me to deal with, I had two boys as a result of my first marriage. And my youngest, Michael, when the divorce was happening, decided he was going to join the Marines. And he joined the Marines, and he served over in Afghanistan, and then he went back and served in Iraq. And he was infantry. You know, this is what they call the tip of the spear. You know, and they don't put these guys in nice places, you know. And, you know, there were firefights, and there were innocents that were killed, and it was there was ugly stuff that went on there. And when this kid came back, I realized that, you know, my son was a lot older than I was, okay, and some of the things he experienced. 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago, 4 months after he got out of the service, he had been in for 4 years, my son was killed in a motorcycle accident. And it was Labor Day in 2008. And what do you do? Okay. And what did I do? I had to go through. The grief is still there. The sadness still hits me. But all I can do, you know, again, is open up and let God heal. You know, God doesn't cause bad things to happen. But, you know, if we open up and we let the healing come, God will come in and heal. And that's the lesson I've had to learn. You know, it's just as bad as it hurts, I've got to open up. There's been a lot of joy in my life, too, you know. And, you know, one of them is my wife, Tina. We've been married a little over 2 years. I met Tina through Area Service. A little plug there for Area Service. It's great, great stuff. I also have the blessing of my older son, and I use that word blessing guardedly, you know. Sometimes blessings hurt. We're going through a lot of stuff right now. But really what I've been given a growing sense of purpose, and I've been given a growing sense of love and connectedness to others. And, you know, the thing that I'm really learning, you know, is that, that by practicing this whole bit of honesty, I'm learning to be open to life. Okay? I don't have to be scared to live. It's filled with joy. It's filled with sadness. It's filled sometimes with incredible joy, with incredible difficulties, you know. But today, as a result of this program, the steps, people like you, my sponsor, I can show up and I can be a part of it. Thank you very much.
Beautiful. Okay. We have some time left, and my instructions were to encourage audience participation. Ask Dick if he can come up and share a few minutes, and anyone else that feels like they have some questions for these guys or would like to share a little bit, please come see me on the side.
Hello, my name is Dick Kessler, and I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the Seekers Group in Lamar, Colorado, down in the southeast corner of the state. If you're ever there, stop by. There ain't nothing but cowboys and roughnecks live down there. There's about 18 people if we got a full meeting. I've been to meetings in all 50 states and 7 foreign countries. My sobriety date is April the 3rd, 1969. And ain't nothing I did. All I didn't do is didn't drink and didn't die. That's all. And then God took care of the rest of it. And I love Jimmy, you know. He gave me a lot of notice about 5 minutes ago. He told me he's going to die. I don't know what difference it makes. All I do is shut my eyes and say, God, help me say what I'm supposed to say. I'm going to tell you about honesty and recovery. When I came into AA in 1968, I didn't stay sober. I kept drinking until 1969. And they put me in the hospital, and I'll make a long story short, and I got out of the hospital. We didn't have treatment centers back then. And I was going to the AA meeting. And my old cowboy that sponsored me met me at the door. And he always used to talk about his old home place down on the river. Well, his old home place was 47,000 acres down there. That's the country I live in. It's like that. And he said to me, he said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Well, I come here to quit drinking." He said, "No, you didn't." He said, "You quit drinking 6, 8 days, whatever it was, they put you in the hospital. That's when you quit drinking." And I said, "Well, what am I doing here then?" And he told me something that I hope every one of you hear today. He said, "You're here to develop a manner of living where you no longer find it necessary to take a drink." That's what we're here for. We're here to learn how to live in a manner that we no longer find it necessary to take a drink. And I said, "How do you do that?" He said, "You work them steps." And I said, "Floyd, I can't work them steps." And he always used to say, "I know." He said, "I know." I said, "Why can't I?" He said, "You ain't taking the two pre-step steps." I said, "What's a pre-two-step step?" Pre-step steps. He said, "It's in the book. Read it." I read the book, come back next Sunday night, and I told him it ain't in there. He said he knew. But he said, "It says in there, and more about alcoholism, is that you admit to your innermost self that you are alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery." Now, I'm going to tell you something. That's honesty. That's surrender. You admit it in here, not here. You admit it here that you're alcoholic. And that is the first step in recovery. Second precept steps is it says if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. Commitment. Are you ready to go to any lengths? Floyd said that means if your ass falls off, you don't drink. You come back and we'll show you how to put it on. If your wife leaves or stays, you don't drink. No matter what happens in your life, you don't drink. People say today, and I guess they're right, I don't know. They say, I have a choice today to drink or not to drink. I don't. You give me the chance to make a choice every day for 41 years, and I'll guarantee you, one day I'd have made the wrong choice. He said, your option to drink is gone. You no longer have that option. And that's the way I look at it. I quit drinking. Now I'm developing a manner of living, and I'm still developing that. And I made a big mistake. Don't ever do this. I told God about 15 years ago, "God, I'm bored. Give me something to do." And he put crackhead hookers in my life. And I'm going to tell you something. I thought I knew something about alcohol and drugs. I don't know nothing. I put 23 of those girls in treatment in 2-year period. And now, they called me Big Dog. And it's nothing I did. I never asked one of them, "You want to go get help?" I just go down to Colfax. You ever been to Denver? Go down on East Colfax. And I just hang out, and they would come to me. And they would talk to me. And you know, I get calls from them every week, 3 or 4 calls from some of them girls because they ain't got nobody else to talk to, I guess. And this one girl said to me, she said, "I can't help but lie." I said, "Then don't open your damn mouth." Well, I'm serious. I asked Floyd, "What does that mean when I say develop a manner of living?" He says, "That means you don't lie. Means you don't cheat. Means you don't steal. If you go to work for 50 cents an hour, you work just as hard as if you went to work for $10 an hour. If you don't like it, quit and find another job. You say what you're going to do, and you do it." Okay? You say what you're going to do, and you tell the damn truth. My grandma one time was in a nursing home, and I went to see her, and I said, "Well, I got to go. We're having a birthday party." She said, "Who?" I said, "Oh, a guy in AA. He's got 2 years. He said, "What do you mean 2 years? 2 years? I said, "Well, he hasn't drank in 2 years, and we're having a party." She said, "You had a party for him because he didn't drink for 2 years? I said, "Yeah." She said, "Well, I haven't drank in 92 years. Nobody give me a damn party." And you know what she said? "Why should you think you're special or get rewarded for doing what you're supposed to do?" And that's a fact. We ain't supposed to live like we used to live. We're supposed to live like the other folks live. I guess they do. I mean, I hear they do. And I believe that. Today I would do my best not to lie. I do my best to live in recovery. And that means to me, living in recovery doesn't mean treat you, you know, that you've heard that old saying, you know, treat other people as you'd have them treat you. No, I don't believe it. Don Fritz was my last sponsor. Some of you knew Don. And I always told Don that Floyd told me, treat people the way they want to be treated. And that's how you stay honest, and that's how you stay in recovery. Thank you. Thank you.
We got one more lady. She's going to take 2 minutes and then we'll close, I promise.
I will. Hi, my name is Kathy. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is April 7th, 1980. And I always say that the international. Spirit rocketed me into the next dimension because my 90th day of sobriety was spent at the New Orleans, Louisiana 1980 convention at the God meeting. And, you know, this meeting is about a sense of belonging. And when I stood up that day and I held hands with 18,000 members of Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew I will never be alone again. And I knew that this program could do for me what I couldn't do for myself. And, you know, the human race is supposed to be a tribal race. And in today's society, you really don't feel that. But here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I am a member of a tribe. And my tribe has a code of ethics. It has a code of behavior. It tells me how I'm supposed to act and what I'm supposed to do. And it says we in front of the steps. Because by myself, I am nothing. By myself, I am a drunk. By myself, I will drink again. And there is nothing but the higher power that will keep me from doing that. And I got on my knees in the bookstore in New York City because I wanted to drink more than I wanted to breathe. And there was an 11-step meeting across, women's meeting across the street. And there was a dirty, stinky, smelly old man's bar next door that would let me drink what I did. I got on my knees. I did the ABCs. And I said, God, do for me what I can't do for myself. Take the obsession. And I never had the obsession again in all these years, and I know that AA does for me what I can't do for myself, and that is why I am responsible to stick my hand out and give back what you guys gave me, and for that I am responsible, and I thank you very much for letting me share.
All right. I'd like to thank our panel for sharing. That was beautiful stuff. The participation from the audience. And also, I'd like to thank Rick at the General Service Office for extending me this privilege of chairing this meeting. And most of all, I'd like to thank all of you guys for coming, because without the spirit of you being in the audience, we wouldn't have had this great meeting. So thank you. Let's close with the Lord's Prayer, please.